We have to be whole people to find whole love, even if we have to make it up for a while. I remembered a younger version of myself as I pondered your letter. I recalled a time 15 years ago, when I was sitting in a cafe with Mr. Sugar. We'd only been lovers for a month, but we were already in deep, thick in the thrall of the "you tell me everything, and I'll tell you everything because I love you so madly" stage. And on this particular afternoon, I was telling him the harrowing tale of how I'd gotten pregnant by a heroin addict the year before, and how I'd felt so angry, sad, and self-destructive over having an abortion that I'd intentionally sliced a shallow line in my arm with a knife, even though I'd never done that before. When I got to the part about cutting myself, Mr. Sugar stopped me. He said, "Don't get me wrong, I want to hear everything about your life, but I want you to know you don't need to tell me this to get me to love you. You don't have to be broken for me." I remember that moment precisely, where he was sitting in relation to where I was sitting, the expression on his face when he spoke, the coat I was wearing. Because when he said what he said, it felt like he'd scooped a hunk of my insides out and shown it to me in the palm of his hand. It wasn't a good feeling. It had never before occurred to me that I thought in order to get a man to love me, I had to appear to be broken for him. And yet when he said it, I recognized it, immediately, humiliatingly, as true. Like truly, uly true. Like, how could I have not known this about myself before, true? Like, what hole can I go and die in now, true? Because here was a man, a good, strong, sexy, kind, astounding, miraculous man, finally calling my bluff. "You don't have to be broken for me." I didn't have to be broken for him, even though parts of me were. I could be every piece of myself, and he'd love me still. My appeal did not rely on my weakness or my need. It relied on everything I was and wanted to be. Yours does too, sweet pea. Bring your needy self when you go on the next date with a potential lover. But bring all your other selves too. The strong one, the generous one, the one who became fatherless too young and survived a war and lost one lover to cancer and another to the challenges of a decade together, but came out wiser and more tender for it. Bring the man you aspire to be, the one who already has the love he longs for. Play every piece of yourself, and play it with all you've got, until you're not playing anymore. That's what Cary Grant did. The lonely boy who lost his mom in the fog of his father's deceit found himself in the magic of wanting to be. His name was Archibald Leach. Yours, Sugar. A Glorious Something Else. Dear Sugar, my older brother has terrorized me for as long as I can remember. The worst physical abuse was probably the time he gave me a concussion when I didn't answer the door quickly enough after he rang the bell because he was locked out. I was 8, he was 12. The worst mental abuse was probably the time he killed my pet rat by cutting her neck and stomach open, then put her on my pillow. I was 11, he was 14. There were all kinds of mini cruelties in between. I literally have no happy memories between us. I have happy memories of my childhood, but none between us. The closest I felt to a brother-sister love was the time he called me a fat, greedy cow for eating the last of the cheese. I either hadn't eaten the cheese or was trying to deflect his anger because I protested that it wasn't me. And he replied that he knew it was me because I was, quote, the person in the house who most loved cheese. I remember that exactly because I was shocked that he knew that about me. I did love cheese, still do. So deep was his disdain for me that the realization that I even existed to him when he wasn't berating or beating me blew my little mind. My parents did what they could, punishing him when they saw it. But I learned quickly that telling was worse than not telling. If he was punished by them, I'd be punished by him. His behavior worsened as he got older, and it also extended beyond me. He had his first trouble with the law in his early teens, got into drugs, dropped out of high school, and has been in and out of jail, rehab, and mental institutions. By the time I was 18, my brother had been arrested multiple times. He had one child and another on the way. I went to college across the country, partly to get away from the havoc he wrought. Now I'm 29. About a year ago, after 10 years of living away from home and learning that just because my brother doesn't love me doesn't mean I'm unlovable, something he would often tell me, by the way, I moved back to my hometown. I'd been living in a big city with no hope of moving up in a soul-crushing career. I love my parents and my niece and nephew, and I missed them. My hometown has a good master's program in a field I'm interested in, and I enrolled. It's been great. I feel energized living again in a town I love. My brother hasn't changed, but I don't have any contact with him unless he calls me for money or needs help with the kids. My parents aren't so lucky. They support him in every way possible. He has horrible credit, so they bought a house for him to, quote, rent from them. Of course, he never pays. He can't get a job with his felony record, so they buy him food and pay for daycare and anything his kids need. Their moms are okay, but can't support them alone. My parents even bought back the iPods they gave to my niece and nephew for Christmas last year after my brother pawned them. Of course, he treats my parents just as you would expect a meth cokehead sociopath to treat people. He steals from them, calls them names, threatens to physically harm them, lies to them about everything and anything. My parents get upset, draw the line, call everything the last straw, but they always give him a second chance, because he is their son. Always. He manipulates them with kindness as easily as he manipulates them with terror. And when he does that, things are fine for a week, then get bad again. Last week it got the worst it's ever been. My mom wouldn't give him money. She'd just given him $100 the day before and had nothing more to give. So he threw a wine bottle at her, spit in her face, threw plates on the floor, rampaged through the house, threw their cat against the wall, and destroyed furniture. He left when my mom called the cops, though he stopped to steal beers from the fridge as he went. Things were strict for a few days. My parents would not return his calls, and they would not allow him into the house again, only interacting with his baby mamas in regards to the kids. But as always, he weaseled his way back in without an apology or even acknowledgement of the incident. Seriously, sugar, that's what gets me. These things happen, and he calls them for a favor the next day and pretends nothing was wrong. My parents have long tried to get him help for anything and everything that could help him stop being a lunatic, but he refuses. It's the rest of the world that has a problem, not him. My parents blame drugs because they didn't see the worst of him as a kid like I did. I think he's just an evil person. Yet I would forgive him the nastiness of his brotherhood. Yes, it was beyond anything normal, but we're adults now, and if he was apologetic and had grown out of his bullying, I would have been fine. I would have welcomed a relationship. But I can't forgive what he's done to my parents. If anyone else treated them this way, there would be restraining orders and court dates. This is a long story, sugar, for a simple question about Christmas. I want my brother out of my life. I think about what he's done to my parents, and I feel such an impotent rage. While writing this letter to you, I had to leave the computer at points to calm down because my fingers were shaking. I don't want to sit across the table from someone who's called my mother a fucking cunt. But as long as my parents let him in, I feel I can't cut him out. We always have a family Christmas, but this year I want to put my foot down. I want to say that I won't be there when he is. I'll do whatever my parents want, because I love them, but I won't do anything involving him, because I love them. I cannot abide anyone who would hurt them. He's stolen their peace of mind, their belief in themselves as good people, and their identities, literally, having committed such fraud via their credit cards and bank accounts. Because they refuse to press charges, their credit is shot. I worry that refusing to see my brother at Christmas would be an empty gesture, and that it would only cause more drama and pain in my parents' lives. I would miss my niece and nephew on Christmas, and I want to make a normal day for them. Though I see them all the time since my parents take care of them 99% of the time when my brother has custody. But I don't know what else I can do. I feel so powerless, the same way I felt as an 11-year-old living with someone who threatened to kill me on a weekly basis. I can't do anything to help my parents, and they won't do anything to help themselves. I can't talk to friends about this, because they don't understand why my parents don't cut him off. My parents have been told by lawyers, cops, therapists, and friends, and me, that they are enabling my brother and that they should cut ties with him. But they won't. I've given up on trying to change their approach. I just want to feel in control of who I have in my life. I don't think I should have to pretend to love someone who hurts my parents. Yet I know my parents would be hurt if I refused to have Christmas with them and my brother. They'd see it as a judgment on them. Sugar, what should I do? Love and kisses, C. Dear C, screw Christmas. Something far more important is at stake. That would be your emotional well-being, as well as the dignity and grace and integrity of your life. It's such a cliche, but it's true. You must set boundaries. Fucked up people will try to tell you otherwise, but boundaries have nothing to do with whether you love someone or not. They are not judgments, punishments, or betrayals. They are a purely peaceable thing. The basic principles you identify for yourself that define the behaviors that you will tolerate from others, as well as the responses you will have to those behaviors. Boundaries teach people how to treat you, and they teach you how to respect yourself. In a perfect world, our parents model healthy personal boundaries for us. In your world, you must model them for your parents, for whom boundaries have either never been in place or have gone gravely askew. Emotionally healthy people sometimes behave badly. They lose their tempers, say things they either shouldn't have said or could have said better, and occasionally allow their hurt, fear, or anger to compel them to act in inappropriate, unkind ways. They eventually acknowledge this and make amends. They are imperfect, but essentially capable of discerning which of their behaviors are destructive and unreasonable, and they attempt to change them, even if they don't wholly succeed. That's called being human. The situation you describe is different, C. It's a deeply embedded family system that's entirely off-kilter. Your story reads like a hostage tale, one in which your destructive and irrational brother is holding the gun. He has taught you and your parents how to treat him, and you all obey, even when it's nuts to do so. In what universe does a man assault his mother, abuse her cat, and ransack her house? Yours, which means you must exile yourself from it, or you will suffer forever. You must make a world of your own. You can take the first steps now, but the internal weeding out of so much familial dysfunction is going to be a years-long process, no doubt. I strongly encourage you to seek counseling. So let's talk about Christmas. What a terrible situation you're in. Your brother is a sociopath, and your parents are his suckers. There is no way to extricate yourself from this without extricating yourself. You want to cut off all ties with your brother, so do that. Remember what I said about boundaries not having anything to do with whether you loved someone or not? Here's where that part comes in. Your parents are good people who have lost themselves in a nightmare. I don't agree with their continued support of your brother, but I understand their impulse to do so. Your brother is their son, the boy they'd have died for probably from the minute he was born. But they didn't have to die for him. He's killing them instead. You mustn't stand by a willing onlooker. I'm not telling you that. You're telling me that. So don't stand by. Tell your parents you love them, and then simply love them. Give to them all the gorgeous daughterness you have inside of you, but do not participate in their self-destruction. Inform them that you will be cutting off all ties with your brother and map out a plan for seeing them on Christmas and beyond. Don't let them try to talk you out of your decision, even if your decision means you spend Christmas alone. Let this be the first step of many in your liberation from the tyranny of your brother. As for your niece and nephew, I hope you can continue to be a presence in their lives. How about approaching their mothers to make arrangements to see them when they're not under your brother's care? You didn't ask about this, but I'm terribly worried about those kids. You say their mothers are okay, but you also say your brother, who is not okay, has partial custody of his children. Even if your parents take care of them 99% of the time, it doesn't sound to me like your brother should be the legal custodian of anyone right now, even for a little while. I encourage you to investigate ways you can protect those children by working with your nieces and nephews' mothers, and possibly your parents, to legally limit your brother's contact with them. Your fear about your parents being hurt by your choices is valid. They will likely feel some pain when you tell them about your plans. Your cooperation and their wildly codependent behaviors has no doubt been a consolation to them. When you set new boundaries, there's often strife and sorrow, but your life will be changed for the better. And maybe, just maybe, the example you set will motivate your parents to make some changes of their own. Lastly, what I'd like to impress upon you is this. In spite of the complexity of your situation, it's notable that you didn't waver when it came to what you know to be the right thing to do. That's because you know the right thing to do. So do it. It's hard, I know. It's one of the hardest things you'll ever have to do. And you're going to bawl your head off doing it. But I promise you, it will be okay. Your tears will be born of grief, but also of relief. You will be better for them. They will make you harder, softer, cleaner, dirtier, free. A glorious something else awaits. Yours, Sugar. A Tunnel That Wakes You. Dear Sugar, I have a serious problem with alcohol. It freaks me out. It even wakes me up in my sleep because I'm terrified of this tunnel I keep going further into. No one has ever said anything to me about it because I've always been professional, calm, laid back, and in control. I don't think I have control anymore, and it seriously scares me. I drink before work, when I wake up, drink during lunch, and drink as soon as I get home to fall asleep, when no one can see me doing it. But I also drink out socially, with my friends, and they are impossible not to drink around, and they actually prefer to see me on, which is the only state I seem to be comfortable with now. I don't think I can give up drinking out socially, because without my friends, I would probably just end up drinking more at home alone. I know you're not a psychologist, but I would like to get some unbiased advice about this. I've tried to approach some people about this before, including therapy, but it has proved fruitless, and also really embarrassing. I guess I'm hoping you have the magic, easy solution to this, and I'm going to assume there probably isn't one. Thanks, Drinker. Dear Drinker, my unbiased advice is that you know you're addicted to alcohol and you need help. You're right that there is no magic, easy solution to this, sweet pea, but there is a solution. It's that you stop using alcohol, privately, socially, morning, noon, night, and probably forever. You will do this when you're ready to do this. To be ready, you need only the desire to change your life. To succeed, most people need a community of support. Alcoholics Anonymous is a good place to begin. There you will find those who struggle in the same ways you do. People who once told themselves the same lies about what was impossible. Addiction is a tunnel that wakes you up in the middle of the night. Everything else happens out here, in the light. Yours, Sugar. How the Real Work is Done. Dear Sugar, I am newly, civilly unioned. I love my spouse, wife, dearly, though we have our issues. What appears to me to be our biggest problem, the one that keeps me up some nights, is that she won't get a job. We're a quite poor couple in our mid-20s, both in school. We've been together for 4 years, and in that time my girl has had 3 jobs. One she was laid off from because the job ended, one she quit, and one she was fired from. All these jobs lasted fewer than 6 months. She's made half-hearted attempts to placate me in the year and a half she's been unemployed. Mostly, though, we fight, she cries, she shuts down, she lies and says she's been trying to find a job, even though I know she hasn't. She has moderate social anxiety issues and says she can't work any jobs involving other people because of it. She doesn't even offer up excuses for not applying to any number of other jobs I've suggested. Throwing newspapers, work study in a low-traffic area of her school, selling her lovely quirky crafts online, dishwashing. At one point, she suggested that she would rather donate plasma every week than get a job. Sugar, I'm a full-time student working 2 jobs. We're barely getting by on what I'm bringing in. We frequently must rely on my parents for money, and they're rapidly losing their ability to keep up with my financial needs in addition to their own. I worry so much about this. I worry that my partner will never be motivated enough to hold a job. I worry about what her job prospects are going to be when she reaches 30 in a few years without ever actually having held a long-term job. I worry that, though she sees my struggles, she will never feel guilty enough to get things kicked into gear. What can I possibly do to get her to take job searching seriously? She's emotionally fragile due to years of social anxiety, sexual and emotional abuse from her father, and a recurring eating disorder. Because of that, I don't want to threaten her with any ultimatums, because I wouldn't mean any of them, and I fear it would do more harm than good. My girl's got a good heart, but she is so afraid of failure that she willfully ignores how much I sacrifice to keep our rent paid. I love her, and she loves me, yet I feel I'm without a partner in this. I don't know what to do next. Please help. Working for two. Dear Sugar, my husband makes me laugh every day. Every day. Multiple times. He's been my best friend for years and is still my favorite person in the world. He's enriched my life in so many innumerable ways, and he has told me that I have reciprocated that enrichment. I do love him so. So. And I'm quite certain he loves me. The issue is that he's been unemployed for over 3 years. He did try to find a job for a while, and I believe he still occasionally does. But now I think he feels unqualified for anything other than the job he used to hate, and also that he has no reason to be hired for anything else. Inertia has taken him over. He wants to write, but feels unworthy, so he doesn't write. He is brilliant and funny and erudite, but he sees none of that. He doesn't paint, sculpt, whatever might give him fulfillment, or do anything that would move him forward in his life. I would be happy with him doing anything, and I truly mean that. Yet he seems to be stuck. He's also bipolar and self-hating and all of that. Fortunately, my job carries us financially, but only barely. The house is clean, the laundry is done, the dog is walked, but in 3 years, he hasn't been able to figure out a way to financially contribute to our household. He's stressed out about the fact that we have trouble paying our bills, but he does nothing, truly nothing, to change it. If I had plenty of money, I'd be fine with this, but I don't. I've been carrying this load alone for a long time. I have repeatedly tried to talk to him about this, to no avail. I love him so much, and I'm so sad about this. I think my staying with him may be ruining both our lives. Perhaps my support is keeping him from fulfilling his dreams. What do you think, Sugar? Responsible One. Dear women, as I'm sure you both know, there is nothing inherently wrong with a spouse who makes no money. The most common scenario in which it makes sense for one spouse to earn an income while the other does not is when the couple has a child or children who must be cared for, which goes along with a domestic life that requires constant vigilance of the cleaning, shopping, cooking, washing, folding, tidying up, taking the cat to the vet and the kids to the dentist variety. In this situation, and others like it, the quote, non-working spouse is often doing more work, hour for hour, than the working spouse. And though on paper it appears that the one with the job is making a greater financial contribution to the household than the one who stays at home, if you ran the numbers and figured out what it would cost to employ someone to do the work of the non-working spouse, it becomes apparent that one should probably shut their big trap when it comes to who is contributing what. There are other reasons, usually more fleeting, that one spouse may not be earning money in any given period. If he or she is unemployed, or seriously ill, or attending school full-time, or caring for an infirm or dying parent, or working in a field in which the money comes only after an extended period of what may or may not turn out to be unpaid labor. Neither of you appears to be in any of those circumstances. While it's technically true that both of your spouses are unemployed, it seems clear that something more complex is at play here. Your spouse, working for two, has such a spotty and brief record of employment that unemployment is her customary mode rather than a temporary state of affairs. Your spouse, responsible one, has apparently drifted into a post-unemployment funk and has given up the search for a job. You both feel overly burdened and seriously bummed out. You're both desperate for change. You've both shared your feelings with your partners, and been met with compassionate indifference, i.e., I feel terrible, sweetie, but I'm not going to do a damn thing about it. What a mess. I hope it's not going to be news to you when I say you can't make your partners get jobs. Or at least you can't make them get jobs by doing what you've done so far, appealing to their better nature regarding what's fair and reasonable, imploring them to act out of their concern for you and your wishes, as well as your collective financial well-being. Whatever dark angst is keeping your spouses from taking responsibility for their lives, depression, anxiety, a loss of self-confidence, a fear-based desire to maintain the status quo, it's got a greater hold on them than any angry fits you've pitched about being the only one bringing in any dough. It's a truism of transformation that if we want things to be different, we have to change ourselves. I think both of you are going to have to take this to heart the way anyone who has ever changed anything about their lives has had to take it to heart, by making it not just a nice thing we say, but a hard thing we do. Your spouses may or may not decide to get jobs in response to your changes, but that is out of your control. The way I see it, there are two paths out of your misery. They are, A, accept the fact that your partner won't get a job, or even seriously delve into the reasons he or she won't seek one, or B, decide your partner's refusal to contribute financially is unacceptable, and end the relationship, or at least break it off until circumstances change. So let's say you went with option A. Both of you express love and adoration for your partners. You don't want to lose them. How might you accept your deadbeat darlings for who they are at this era of their lives? Is this possible? Is what they give you worth the burden they place upon you? Are you willing to shelve your frustrations about your partner's fiscal failings for a period of time? If so, how long? Can you imagine feeling okay with being the sole employed member of your union a year from now? 3 years? 10? Might you together agree to downsize and reduce expenses so that your single income becomes more feasible? What if you rethought the whole thing? What if instead of lamenting the fact that your partner is unemployed, the two of you embraced it as a choice you made together? Reframing it as a mutually agreed upon decision in which you are the breadwinners and your partners are the significantly supportive, non-income earning helpmates would give you a sense of agency that's lacking now. Working for two, you don't mention if your partner does more than her share around the house, but responsible one, you state that the house is clean, the laundry is done, the dog is walked. That's something. In fact, it's quite a lot. It's not money, but your husband is positively contributing to your lives by seeing to those things. Oodles of people with jobs would be deeply pleased to return to a clean house that doesn't contain mountains of dirty laundry and a dog demanding to go out. Many people pay people to do those things for them, or they return from work only to have to work another domestic shift. Your husband's unpaid work benefits you. With that in mind, what other ways could your partners lighten your burden if they refuse to lighten it financially? Might you drop a list of your household and individual needs, financial, logistical, domestic, and administrative, and divide the responsibilities in a manner that feels equitable in terms of overall workload, that takes your job into account? While I encourage you to sincerely consider coming to peace with your spouse's perpetual unemployment, I'll admit I'm presenting this option with more optimism than I feel. One thing I noted about both of your letters is that while money is a major stress point, what worries you most deeply isn't money. It's how apathetic your partners are, how indifferent they are to their ambitions, whether they be income earning or not. It would be one thing if your partners were these happy, fulfilled people who simply believe their best contribution to your coupledom would be as homemakers and personal assistants. But it seems clear that your partners have used home and the security of your relationships as a place to retreat and wallow, to sink into rather than rise out of their insecurities and doubts. So let's talk about option B. Working for two, you say that you won't give your partner an ultimatum, but I encourage you to rethink that. Perhaps it will help if you come to see what I see so clearly now, that you and responsible one are the ones who've been given ultimatums, at least of an unstated, passive-aggressive sort. Ultimatums have negative connotations for many because they're often used by bullies and abusers, who tend to be comfortable pushing their partner's backs against a wall, demanding that he or she choose this or that, all or nothing. But when used by emotionally healthy people with good intentions, ultimatums offer a respectful and loving way through an impasse that will sooner or later destroy our relationship on its own anyway. Besides, the two of you have been up against the wall for years now, forced by your partners to be the sole financial providers, even when you have repeatedly stated that you will not and cannot continue to be. You've continued. Your partners have made their excuses and allowed you to do what you said you don't want to do, even though they know it makes you profoundly unhappy. Your ultimatum is simple. It's fair. And it's stating your own intentions, not what you hope theirs will be. It's, I won't live like this anymore. I won't carry our financial burdens beyond my desires or capabilities. I won't enable your inertia. I won't, even though I love you. I won't because I love you, because doing so is ruining us. The difficult part is, of course, what to do in the wake of those words. But you don't have to know exactly what it will be right away. Maybe it will be breaking up. Maybe it will be mapping out a course of action that will save your relationships. Maybe it will be the thing that finally forces your partners to change. Whatever it is, I strongly advise you both to seek answers to the deeper questions underlying your conflicts with your partners while you figure it out. Your joint and individual issues run deeper than someone not having a job. You can do this. I know you can. It's how the real work is done. We can all have a better life if we make one. Yours, Sugar. The ghost ship that didn't carry us. Dear Sugar, for those of us who aren't lucky enough to just know, how is a person to decide if he or she wants to have a child? I'm a 41-year-old man and have been able thus far to postpone that decision while I got all the other pieces of my life in order. Generally speaking, I've enjoyed myself as a childless human. I've always had a hunch that as I continued on my path, my feelings about parenthood would coalesce one way or the other, and I would follow that where it took me. Well, my path has taken me here, to the point where all of my peers are having children and expounding on the wonders, and of course trials, of their new lives, while I keep enjoying the same life. I love my life. I love having the things that I know will be in shorter supply if I become a parent. Things like quiet, free time, spontaneous travel, pockets of non-obligation. I really value them. I'm sure that everyone does, but on the ground gradient of the human condition, I feel I sit farther to one end than most. To be blunt, I'm afraid to give that up, afraid that if I become a parent, I will miss my old life. As a male, I know I have a little more leeway in terms of the biological clock, but my partner, who is now 40, does not. She is also on the fence about a child. And while the finer points of our specific concerns on the subject may differ, we are largely both grappling with the same questions. At this point, we're trying to tease out the signal from the noise. Do we want a child because we really want a child? Or are we thinking about having one because we're afraid we will regret not having one later? We both now accept that the time for deferment is coming to a close, and we need to step up and figure it out. When I try to imagine myself as a father, I often think back to my two wonderful cats that I had from the age of 22 until I buried them in the backyard almost 2 years ago. They were born prematurely to a mother that was too sick to care for them. I bottle-fed them, woke up in the middle of the night to wipe their bottoms, was there for every stage of their growth, from kitten to cat, and basically loved the bejesus out of them for their entire lives. I raised them to be trusting, loving creatures, and I did it consciously, even thinking at the time that it was great training for the day I had a child, if that felt like the right thing. I really was their dad, and I loved it. Yet I also loved it that I could put an extra bowl of food and water on the floor and split town for a 3-day weekend. So here I am now exploring the idea of becoming a father, exploring it for real and deeply. Sugar, help me. Signed, Undecided. Dear Undecided, there's a poem I love by Tomas Tranströmer called The Blue House. I think of it every time I consider questions such as yours about the irrevocable choices we make. The poem is narrated by a man who is standing in the woods near his house. When he looks at his house from this vantage point, he observes that it's as if he'd just died and he was now, quote, seeing the house from a new angle. It's a wonderful image, that just dead man among the trees. And it's an instructive one, too. There is a transformative power in seeing the familiar from a new, more distant perspective. It's in this stance that Transtromer's narrator is capable of seeing his life for what it is, while also acknowledging the lives he might have had. The poem strikes a chord in me because it's so very sadly and joyfully and devastatingly true. Every life, Transtromer writes, has a sistership, one that follows quite another route than the one we ended up taking. We want it to be otherwise, but it cannot be. The people we might have been live a different phantom life than the people we are. And so the question is, who do you intend to be? As you've stated in your letter, you believe you could be happy in either scenario, becoming a father or remaining childless. You wrote to me because you want clarity about which course to take, but perhaps you should let that go. Instead, take a figurative step into the forest, like that man in the poem, and simply gaze for a while at your blue house. I think if you did, you'd see what I see, that there will likely be no clarity, at least at the outset. There will only be the choice you make and the sure knowledge that either one will contain some loss. You and I are about the same age. I have two children, whom I birthed in close succession in my mid-30s. If a magic baby fairy had come to me when I was childless and 34 and promised to grant me another 10 years of fertility so I could live a while longer in the serene, feline-focused, fabulously unfettered life I had, I'd have taken it in a flash. I, too, had spent my adult years assuming that someday, when it came to becoming a mother, I'd just know. I, too, placed myself on the leave-me-the-hell-alone end of the grand gradient of the human condition. I decided to become pregnant when I did, because I was nearing the final years of my fertility, and because my desire to do this thing that everyone said was so profound was just barely stronger than my doubts about it were. So I got knocked up, with a total lack of clarity. On this, Mr. Sugar and I were in complete accord. Though we were generally pleased to be having a baby, we were also deeply alarmed. We liked to have sex and ramble around foreign countries in decidedly unbaby-safe ways, and spend hours reading in silence on two couches that faced each other across the living room. We liked to work for days without interruption on our respective art forms, and take unscheduled naps, and spend weeks backpacking in the wilderness. We did not, throughout my pregnancy, have many conversations about how awesome it was going to be once our baby was born, and doing these things would become either indisputably or close to impossible. Mostly we had ambivalent, mildly sickening talks about how we hoped we hadn't made a dreadful mistake. "What if we love the baby, but not as much as everyone says we will?" I'd ask him every couple of weeks. "What if the baby bores us, or annoys us, or grosses us out? What if we want to ride our bicycles across Iceland, or hike around Mongolia?" Fuck. We do want to ride our bicycles across Iceland or hike around Mongolia. My point is not that you should have a baby undecided. It's that possibly you expect to have a feeling about wanting to have a baby that will never come. And so the clear desire for a baby isn't an accurate gauge for you when you're trying to decide whether or not you should have one. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. So what then is an accurate gauge? You say that you and your partner don't want to make the choice to become parents simply because you're afraid you will regret not having one later. But I encourage you to re-examine that. Thinking deeply about your choices and actions from the stance of your future self can serve as both a motivational and a corrective force. It can help you stay true to who you really are, as well as inspire you to leverage your desires against your fears. Not regretting it later is the reason I've done at least 3/4 of the best things in my life. It's the reason I got pregnant with my first child, even though I'd have appreciated another decade from the magic baby fairy. And it's also the reason I got pregnant with my second child, even though I was already overwhelmed by the first. Because you are content in your current childless life, attempting to determine what you might regret later strikes me as the best way for you to meaningfully explore if having a child is important to you. So much so that I suspect that whether you'll regret it later is the only question you must answer. It is the very one that will tell you what to do. You already know the answers to everything else. You know you're open to becoming a father, and that you're also open to remaining childless. You know you've gotten pleasure and satisfaction from nurturing the lives of others in the form of your dear cats, and also that you get deep satisfaction from the freedom and independence a child-free life allows. What don't you know? Make a list. Write down everything you don't know about your future life, which is everything, of course, but use your imagination. What are the thoughts and images that come to mind when you picture yourself at twice the age you are now? What springs forth if you imagine the 82-year-old self who opted to keep enjoying the same life? And what when you picture the 82-year-old self with a 39-year-old son or daughter? Write down same life and son or daughter, and underneath each, make another list of the things you think those experiences would give to and take from you, and then ponder which entries on your list might cancel each other out. With the temporary loss of a considerable portion of your personal freedom in middle age be significantly neutralized by the experience of loving someone more powerfully than you ever have? Would the achy uncertainty of never having been anyone's father be diffused by the glorious reality that you got to live your life relatively unconstrained by the needs of another? What is a good life? Write good life and list everything that you associate with a good life. Then rank that list in order of importance. Have the most meaningful things in your life come to you as a result of ease or struggle? What scares you about sacrifice? What scares you about not sacrificing? So there you are on the floor, your gigantic white piece of paper with things written all over it like a ship's sail. And maybe you don't have clarity still. Maybe you don't know what to do. But you feel something, don't you? The sketches of your real life and your sister life are right there before you, and you get to decide what to do. One is the life you'll have. The other is the one you won't. Switch them around in your head and see how it feels. Which affects you on a visceral level? Which won't let you go? Which is ruled by fear? Which is ruled by desire? Which makes you want to close your eyes and jump? And which makes you want to turn and run? In spite of my fears, I didn't regret having a baby. My son's body against mine was the clarity I never had. The first few weeks of his life, I felt honestly rattled by the knowledge of how close I'd come to opting to live my life without him. It was a penetrating, relentless, unalterable thing to be his mother, my life ending and beginning at once. If I could go back in time, I'd make the same choice in a snap. And yet, there remains my sister life. All the other things I could have done instead. I wouldn't know what I couldn't know until I became a mom. And so I'm certain there are things I don't know because I can't know because I did. Who would I have nurtured had I not been nurturing my two children over these past 7 years? In what creative and practical forces would my love have been gathered up? What didn't I write because I was catching my children at the bottoms of slides and spotting them as they balanced along the tops of low brick walls and pushing them endlessly in swings? What did I write because I did? Would I be happier and more intelligent and prettier if I had been free all this time to read in silence on a couch that sat opposite of Mr. Sugar's? Would I complain less? Has sleep deprivation and the consumption of an exorbitant number of Annie's homegrown organic cheddar bunnies taken years off of my life, or added years onto it? Who would I have met if I had bicycled across Iceland and hiked around Mongolia? And what would I have experienced, and where would that have taken me? I'll never know, and neither will you of the life you don't choose. We'll only know that whatever that sister life was, it was important and beautiful, and not ours. It was the ghost ship that didn't carry us. There's nothing to do but salute it from the shore. Yours, Sugar. Your invisible, inner, terrible someone. Dear Sugar, I'm 29 and dating a man that I adore. We're planning to move in together soon. I have a stable job that I hate, but I hope that I'll one day find something I enjoy. I have family and friends and hobbies and interests and love, so much love. And I'm desperately afraid that I'm going to have cancer. I'm terrified that sooner or later I'll be diagnosed. My mother had breast cancer when I was in college. She survived hers, but in some ways she didn't. It broke her, Sugar. My father died of liver cancer when I was in high school. He was never lucky enough to be counted a survivor. My grandmother had a brain tumor when I was a newborn. She didn't live to see my first birthday. As much as I take care of my health, as much as I try to be careful, I have this niggling doubt that my genes are setting me up for failure. I know you can't tell me whether or not I will have cancer, and I know you can't tell me when. But what I'm struggling with, what I need help figuring out, is how to make the decisions in my life while keeping this possibility in mind. You know the decisions I mean, the big ones. How do I decide whether or not to get married? How do I look into the face of this man I adore and explain to him what he might have to go through if I'm diagnosed? And worse, if I don't make it. I've already decided not to have children. How can I saddle a child with something that I don't even think I can face myself? How do I plan for the future when there may be no future to plan for? They say live your life to the fullest because there may be no tomorrow. But what about the consequences of no tomorrow on the people that you love? How do I prepare them for what I might have to go through? How do I prepare myself? Scared of the future. Dear Scared of the Future, there's a crazy lady living in your head. I hope you'll be comforted to hear that you're not alone. Most of us have an invisible, inner, terrible someone who says all sorts of nutty stuff that has no basis in truth. Sometimes when I'm all pretzeled up inside and my own crazy lady is nattering on, I'll stop and wonder where she got her information. I'll ask her to reveal her source. I'll demand some proof. Did her notions come from actual facts based in reason? Or did I dredge them up from the hell pit that burns like a perpetual fire at the bottom of my needy, selfish, famished little soul? Is there credible evidence that my friends secretly don't like me very much? Or were they all simply deep in conversation when I walked into the room and it took them a beat to say hello? Was the acquaintance who said, "With class sizes that big, I'd never send my son to public school," actually saying that I was a second-rate mother, recklessly destroying my children because there are 30 kids in their classes? Or was she simply sharing her own complex parenting decisions with me? When I receive letters from people who disagree passionately with a particular piece of advice I've given in this column, is it true that it would be absolutely impossible for every reader to agree with me on every point? Or that I'm a stupid piece of know-nothing shit who should never write again? If you asked me to draw a picture of myself, I'd draw two. One would be a portrait of a happy, self-confident, regular-looking woman, and the other would be a close-up of a giant, gaping mouth that's ravenous for love. Many days I have to silently say to myself, "It's okay. You are loved. You are loved even if some people don't love you, even if some people hate you. You're okay even if sometimes you feel slighted by your friends, or you sent your kids to school someplace that someone else would not send her kid, or you wrote something that riled up a bunch of people." I have to cut the crazy lady to the quick rather often. Over the years, my emotional well-being has depended on it. If I let her get the upper hand, my life would be smaller, stupider, squatter, sadder. So will yours if you let it. You have my deepest sympathy and my most sincere understanding. But you're not thinking clearly on this. You're granting the crazy lady way too much power. Your sorrow and fear has clouded your ability to be reasonable about your mortality. And if you continue in this vein, it's going to rob you of the life you deserve. The one in which your invisible inner terrible someone finally shuts her trap. You do not need to look into your lover's eyes and explain to him what he might have to go through should you be diagnosed with cancer. Tell him about your family's experiences with cancer and about how you made it through those difficult times. Share your fears with him and your grief. But don't make the illogical line from your relative's real illnesses to your non-existent one. Only the crazy lady is pretty convinced you'll get cancer and die young. All the rest of us are entirely in the dark. Yes, you need to be aware of your risks and monitor your health, but do so while remembering that in most cases, a genetic history of any given disease is only one predictor of your own likelihood of getting it. Any of us could die any day of any number of causes. Would you expect your partner to explain what you might have to go through should he die in a car accident, of heart failure, or by drowning? Those are things that could happen too. You are a mortal being, like every human and June bug, like every black bear and salmon. We're all going to die, but only some of us are going to die tomorrow or next year or in the next half century. And by and large, we don't know which of us it will be, when, and of what. That mystery is not the curse of our existence. It's the wonder. It's what people are talking about when they talk about the circle of life we're all part of, whether we sign up to be or not. The living, the dead, those being born right this moment, and the others who are fading out. Attempting to position yourself outside the circle isn't going to save you from anything. It isn't going to keep you from your grief or protect those you love from theirs when you're gone. It isn't going to extend your life or shorten it. Whatever the crazy lady whispered in your ear was wrong. You're here. So be here, dear one. You're okay with us for now. Yours, Sugar. Waiting by the phone. Dear Sugar, in this age of Facebook and Twitter, how are we supposed to get over our exes who we're trying to be friends with, while being slammed with status updates and tweets, or as I like to call them, little 140 characters of pain? Yours, constantly hitting refresh. Dear constantly hitting refresh, we aren't supposed to get over our exes by tracking their every move on Facebook and Twitter, sweetie. Facebook and Twitter are heartbreak torture machines. Back in Sugar's youth, the goddamn telephone was torture enough. Here's how it went. Would it ring? It would not ring. Should you call? You should not call. But you always called. You couldn't help but call because your heart was crushed, and you thought maybe if you talked it out one more time, the person who crushed your heart would change his or her mind and uncrush it. So you'd sit for a while with the phone in your hand, and it would feel like the phone was literally on fire with your pain and longing. And finally you'd dial, and it would ring and ring, until at last the answering machine picked up, and there would be his or her voice, so cheerful, so flip, so excruciatingly out of reach. And the beep would beep, and you'd start speaking into the silence, sounding remotely like the cool, strong, reasonably detached person you used to be before the beloved owner of the answering machine crushed your heart. But within about 4 seconds, your voice would go all high and shaky and desperate, and you'd stammer something out about how you just wanted to call to say hi because you missed him or her so much, and because, after all, you were still friends, and because, well, you just wanted to talk, even though there was really nothing more to say, and you'd finally shut up and hang up, and a millisecond later, you'd burst into gasping sobs. Then you'd sob and sob and sob so hard you couldn't stand up, until finally you'd go quiet, and your head would weigh 700 pounds, and you'd lift it from your hands and rise to walk into the bathroom to look at yourself solemnly in the mirror. And you'd know for sure that you were dead. Living, but dead. And all because this person didn't love you anymore. Or even if he or she loved you, he or she didn't want you. And what kind of life was that? It was no life. There would be no life anymore. There would only be one unbearable minute after another, and during each of those minutes, this person you wanted would not want you, And so you would begin to cry again, and you'd watch yourself cry pathetically in the mirror until you couldn't cry anymore. So you'd stop. You'd wash your face and brush your hair and apply lip balm, even though you now looked like a tropical blowfish. And you'd float out to your car and the jeans that were suddenly two sizes too big because your heart was so positively crushed that you hadn't eaten in a week. No worries. Those same jeans will soon be two sizes too small once you hit the binge phase of your broken heart. You'd get in your car and begin to drive. And as you drove, you'd think, I have no idea where I'm even going. But of course you'd know. You always knew. You'd drive past his or her house just to see. And there he or she would be, visible through the front window, lit by the lamp you once switched off and on with a casual and familiar ease. You'd see him or her for only a fleeting moment, but that image would sear itself into your brain. He or she would be laughing a little, obviously in conversation with someone maddeningly out of view. And you'd want to stop, to investigate, to watch. But you couldn't stop, because what if he or she looked out and saw you? So you'd drive home and sit in the dark near the phone. You would not hit refresh. You would not read that the man or woman who crushed your heart is now friends with anyone who has an incredibly hot-sounding name. Monique. Jack. You would not view photographs of your ex standing disturbingly and drunkenly close to strange, good-looking men or women at parties, or read veiled references to anything that might possibly be a blowjob. There would be no exposure to declarations about what sort of fun was recently had or about to be had, or agitating lamentations about the single life. There would be no LOLs or TMIs or ROTFLMFAOs or sassily winking symbols composed of a period and a semicolon from people named Jack or Monique. There would be nothing. There would be only you in the dark near the phone that won't ever ring, and the dawning realization that you have to move on. In order to get over your ex, you have to move on, constantly hitting refresh, and at least temporarily unfriending and unfollowing him or her will help you do so. Being friends with someone who once broke your heart is fine and dandy, but it's almost always a good idea to take a breather between this and that. I strongly encourage you to resist the temptation to devour your ex's every musing, darling. Shutting off that cyber feedback will feel like hell those first few days, but I'm certain you'll soon realize how much better you can breathe when you're not constantly breathing in the fumes of your ex's life without you. Yours, Sugar. We are all savages inside. Dear Sugar, I'm jealous. I'm jealous of people who succeed at what I do, write literary fiction. I'm jealous of them even if I love them, or like them, or respect them. Even when I pretend to be happy when my writer friends get good news, the truth is I feel like I swallowed a spoonful of battery acid. For days afterwards, I go around feeling queasy and sad, thinking, why not me? So why not, Sugar? I'm 31. I've written a novel that I'm currently revising while searching for an agent, which is turning out to be more difficult than I imagined. I received a first-rate education, holding a BA from a prestigious college and an MFA from another prestigious college. Several people in my social and literary orbit have gotten the sort of six-figure book deals that I dream of getting. A couple of these people are jerks, so I don't feel guilty for resenting their good fortune. But a few of them are good people whom I like and respect. And worst of all, one is a woman I count among my very best friends. It makes me sick that I don't feel happy for them, especially when it comes to my close friend. But there it is. When I think of their successes, it only reminds me of what I don't have. I want what they have, but it's more than that. Them having what I want pains me. When other writer friends are met with failure, rejections from agents or publishing houses, for example, I admit I feel a tiny lift inside. The feeling is more relief than glee. You know that old saying about misery enjoying company? I don't truly wish others bad, but neither do I honestly wish them well. I know this makes me a shallow, awful person. I know I should be grateful that I have a decent job that allows